So to get things going here, I'm just going to ask you this question straight up, and we can talk about how you come to your answer. As an economist, should the rich pay more taxes?
Well, that's the perfect example of a question on a policy where the answer is intrinsically going to reflect a moral choice. And traditionally, an economist would have focused on the economic efficiency implications of taxing the rich more than taxing the poor.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In today's program, moral psychologists and economists band together to make fiscal policies, well, more human.
If you ask me personally, my preference is that yes, the rich should pay more. But as an economist, my instinct is to say, well, I'm not sure I want to be overly influenced by my own personal preference. I'm Paolo Mauro, Deputy Director in the Fiscal Affairs Department at the International Monetary Fund.
Paolo Mauro is also the author of an article about ethics in public finance in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. So that is a question that economists are faced with all the time. So what are the problems with the thought process that you just described there when it comes to looking at effective policies for things like taxation and public spending?
So the usual approach, the traditional approach in recent decades in economics has been to focus primarily on economic efficiency. And we know that decisions that societies make with regards to taxation or particular expenditures, those are choices that really reflect people's moral perspectives. So what this new work is encouraging us to do is to actually pay a lot more attention to people's moral perspectives, because these influence the political sustainability, the political feasibility of policy choices.
Yeah, so this article that you've written for Finance and Development magazine, and it's based on some research, working papers, as we call them, on the topic of, you know, economists focusing perhaps too much on this idea of economic efficiency. And I heard Joe Stiglitz speak at an event that your institute organized recently, where he brought up this notion of shareholder maximization versus stakeholder maximization. And he said the shareholder maximization approach, which I assume would be akin to, you know, economic efficiency, never results in welfare maximization. Would you agree with him on that?
The best empirical evidence that I'm aware of on the importance that citizens place on notions of fairness as opposed to economic efficiency, to my knowledge, comes from work by Stefanie Stancheva, who has these very large surveys where she tries to figure out how people think about taxation, how people think about public policies. And what she finds in these surveys is that indeed individuals really care a lot more about fairness than economic efficiency. My sense, first, is this is something that resonates with experience in sort of looking at public policies around the world. But my sense is that it's very hard for individuals to really kind of get a feeling for what economic efficiency is going to mean for them, whereas it's easier for them to have a sense of fairness. If they see a public policy that is good for the economy as a whole, but may bring near-term costs for them, then they're going to pay a lot more attention to the issue of distribution and fairness.
Yeah, so that said, why has this economic efficiency first approach persisted?
Well, first of all, because economic efficiency, of course, matters. Yeah. That's something we shouldn't forget. Mm-hmm. But I believe because we as economists want to be viewed as social scientists. Mm-hmm. And as such, we want to at least come across, but I think also in reality, not be overly influenced by our own personal preferences. Mm-hmm. The implication is that when it comes to issues of distribution, we will usually turn again to the preferences of the public, ask policymakers or ask the public, what are your preferences? And then we can design a tax and benefit system that seeks to deliver on those preferences. The other reason is that most economists are trained in the tradition of societies that some people label as WEIRD, the acronym that goes for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And in that tradition, usually, we emphasize moral tenets like the Golden Rule that says that you should treat others the way you want to be treated.
Right.
And that's very important. I think it's a fundamental aspect of morality, but it may not be the whole story for everybody. In fact, in recent work, moral psychologists have found that for a large chunk of the world's population, and even within Western advanced economies, many people pay attention to issues such as loyalty, authority, purity, sanctity when they're looking at morality. And so it's important that we as economists pay more attention to these additional dimensions, additional moral perspectives that may not be as familiar from our traditional training.
So treating people the same way you would like to be treated doesn't necessarily work well when not everyone is like you.
Well, it doesn't tell the whole story. And in fact, another distinction that is becoming more prominent in public discourse is the distinction between universalists or globalists on the one hand and communitarians or nationalists on the other hand. And here the distinction would be a universalist is somebody who truly treats others like they want to be treated, regardless of their proximity in terms of nationality or family ties or religion, whereas a communitarian would be somebody who might be very altruistic, but would be more altruistic vis-a-vis people that this person shares an affinity with. So family members, people who come from the same town, or people from the same nation, the same religion, and so on. So I think there's greater awareness in public discourse of this divide, if you will, between universalists and communitarians. And that's beginning to inform our design of public policies in important ways.
Yeah, and you speak of some of the policy responses to the big issues these days, like job losses from AI and globalization, and the disregard for how important communities are for people's welfare when they're faced with having to leave to find new jobs. And you also talk about immigration. Can you break that down for us a little bit on how policy responses sort of are not getting to the level where they should be?
Sure. And, you know, these are some of the most contentious issues these days. And that's why they're so important and so interesting. Beginning with job losses from automation or globalization, we have this phenomenon of certain communities that feel left behind. And if this had been in the 1980s, economists would have looked at the solution primarily by thinking about the functioning of the labor market, the housing market. The solution would have been, let's make sure that people who are in an area where jobs are being lost are able to move to an area where there are abundant jobs.
Right.
And so let's allow these people to move. Let's give them an incentive to move efficiently. Today, we are realizing that communities are very important to people. And therefore, there is much greater interest in so-called place-based policies, where instead of thinking about people moving, we think about public policies that would provide additional infrastructure or opportunities for retraining locally. So essentially trying to bring the jobs to the people in the communities where they come from.
Right.
So that's a big change in thinking that I think is coming from the greater awareness of the importance of communities to people. The area of immigration is perhaps even more clear. You know, the traditional economic analysis very appropriately looks at costs and benefits for the immigrants, but also for the population that is in the receiving country.
Yeah.
It also looks at items such as wages of unskilled workers. And that all makes sense. But we realize, of course, that notions of how to preserve cultural identity, both for the people who see the immigration coming in, but also for the people who are immigrating, both have to be able to preserve some cultural identity, and that may well be very important to them. So I think that gives a broader picture of the situation, and it has to inform public policies to a greater extent than it has.
I'm just curious here. You've had a long career at the fund, and as an economist, what you're advocating here in your research, more moral perspectives in public and economic policy, has not really been something that economists generally at the fund think about too much. Is this something that has been gnawing at you throughout your career, or is it something that you've recently come to realize?
Well, personally, I've always had an intellectual interest in these issues. And, one of the things that I can say is that I'm much more likely to be a universalist, partly thanks to the good fortune that I've had, and many of my colleagues would also perhaps describe themselves as universalists, exactly because we've been fortunate enough to collaborate with people from all over the world. And so it's in some ways a lot easier for us to sort of accept this notion that we treat everybody the same, regardless of where they come from. But I think what I could add here is that we have been looking for ways of thinking about political economy, sustainability of reforms, making sure that whatever policies are undertaken, they are politically sustainable. So distributional aspects of and implications of public policies, that's always been on our mind. I think this is just a slightly different angle that hopefully can provide additional ways of designing and also explaining public policies in a way that musters political support.
So talk to me about some of the things that are happening in this realm. And in the article, you mentioned that there are some what you call pioneering applications that are showing promise. What are they?
Right. So some people have begun taking these notions of, for example, universalists versus communitarians to the data. Mm-hmm. And to just take one of the early, very successful examples, work by Ben Enke and his co-authors, they show that if you're a universalist, you will typically tend to favor foreign aid, environmental protection, welfare, more spending on healthcare, whereas if you're a communitarian, you would favor spending on the military, on the police and law enforcement, border control. And it gets kind of subtle sometimes. So, for example, a universalist will be less favorable towards spending on the military, but more favorable to United Nations peacekeeping operations, which, on the other hand, are not favored by communitarians. So it is kind of interesting. Even a colleague of mine by the name of Alex Clem and myself have used, we've applied this approach following pioneering work by others. Mm-hmm. And what we looked at was the attitudes of, in our case, we did a survey on residents of the United States in a sample of 3,000 people. We looked at attitudes towards progressive taxation. So this idea that you tax the rich more than you tax the poor. Not surprisingly, we found that universalists tend to be more favorable toward progressive taxation than would be the case for communitarians. However, very interestingly, we did our survey in late 2020. So at the peak of the pandemic, and at the time when quite a lot of people in the United States had unfortunately been adversely affected by the pandemic. And what we show is that people who were directly harmed by the pandemic, either through job loss or through personal illness with COVID, mm-hmm. those people were more likely to be in favor of progressive taxation, even controlling for income, race, education, and other factors.
That's very interesting, because there was also a political transition in play there at that moment.
And interestingly, the switch was greater for communitarians than for universalists. So we took that as potentially suggestive that a very traumatic experience, such as, you know, direct harm from the pandemic, might actually have important implications for how people view public policies going forward. Of course, progressive taxation is the way that you finance basic healthcare and so on. And that may have been at the back of people's minds when they were answering the question.
And that's a nice segue into my last question here, and that is about the role of information in all this. As you point out in your research, the increasingly extreme positions that we're seeing in public policy debates may reflect the lack of information about each other's perspective on any of these given policies. How might you see any attempts at bridging this, the information gap playing out in the public policy sphere?
There's very interesting work here done by psychologists who first ask people, what is your view on, let's say, cap and trade systems for reducing carbon emissions or single payer healthcare system? So complicated public policies where there's a pretty heated debate in the public domain. And in the first round, they get very extreme answers, either pro or against. Then these psychologists ask the same respondents, please explain to me how this policy works. So please explain to me how a single-payer healthcare system works. And that's a pretty difficult thing to explain, which kind of reveals to the respondents that they actually don't quite know what they're talking about.
Right.
And, you know, even for me, it's not a trivial thing to explain.
No.
And so faced with the difficulty in really articulating what these policies are and what their implications would be, then when you ask the same respondents in a further round, okay, now what is your view on the single-payer healthcare system? Then they come up with more moderate positions. Mm-hmm. So the implication is that a potentially better conversation starter would be to simply ask people in the first instance, how does it work? What is it?
So everyone can sort of establish how much they know about the actual process.
Yes, and I guess this is where you were going at the beginning of your question. They also maybe reach a common understanding of what that policy would be and what it would imply. And I think that's potentially very fruitful. Again, some economists have started doing surveys exactly by asking people what their views are on a particular public policy. Let's say it's a tax policy. Then they provide them with factual information. And then they ask them again what their preferences are. And it looks like, we don't really know yet, but it looks like providing information in some cases can persuade people a little bit. The reality is that, you know, you're not going to change somebody's mind within half an hour, because that's how long a survey takes. But it may give us a glimmer of hope that through more sustained provision of information, then we can come to design better public policies.
Fascinating stuff, Paolo. Thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you.
Look for Paolo Mauro's article, Adding Ethics to Public Finance, in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. And you'll find his working paper on the same topic at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing. You can also follow us on Twitter at @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.